open this meeting of the Revenue Committee on the 18th of January. Today we have in front of us property taxation. The presenters are Mary Ayala, is that correct, Mary? And John Phelps. You're on, Mary.
Thank you. Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Before I begin, I'd like to introduce John Phillips to you. He's with the Department of Revenue, legislative liaison for the Property Tax Division. And I wanted to acknowledge him because he collaborated with me to prepare this material for you. And he'll present some of the material to cover some of the more detailed aspects of certain pieces of legislation, which I'm not all that familiar since I'm relatively new. Because of the complexity of property taxes, let me tell you up front that what we are not going to cover.
Could you put your microphone a little closer to you, Mary?
Sure. Please?
Okay. That's better?
That's much better.
Hey.
Okay. I want to advise you ahead of time so you're comfortable with the presentation and you know what we're going to try to avoid. There are several documents that are on the LRO website that deal with the historical changes in property tax legislation. We are not going to focus on the history of, you know, legislative changes, court rulings, etc. We're going to try to cover the current structure. Part one is going to be an overview. It'll give you some background about tax collections, and it provides measures that reflect the property tax burden in the state of Oregon over the past 30 years, just to give you some highlights about how the state's tax burden falls relative to other states. Okay. Part two is going to cover the property tax structure, focusing on the types of property that are taxed, and you'll hear about the legislation that was enacted in 91 and 97 that affected property taxes. John will fill in for me on that. Part three will describe the structure at a sub-state level, that's taxing districts level, and we'll provide you with a number of examples to illustrate how to prepare a tax statement and how to see how compression works given certain changes in taxing of different districts. We thought that might bring in the concept of Measure 5 and Measure 50 mm-hmm. better for you than just talking about it. We'll actually work a few tables. Okay. Well, what's going on? It's not moving.
Thank you.
Cool. Oh, yeah. Okay, hold on.
Okay. There you go. Need some technical help.
Okay, where's that?
There you go.
Okay. Part two, part three, and now we'll shift into part one of the presentation. Oregon's historical growth in property taxes reflects the impact of population growth and economic development, but it also reflects major changes in Oregon's property tax legislation and urban renewal legislation. Part one of the presentation highlights at a statewide level Oregon's legislative changes that contributed to the variability of Oregon's property tax collections for the past 30 years. During these years, property owners reacted to increases in their property taxes by adopting measures that would impose constraints on authority of local government and educational taxing districts to raise their taxes. Therefore, this part of the presentation highlights trends in two measures of tax burden in order to highlight the degree to which the property tax burden declined in Oregon. Concluding part one, we'll compare how Oregon tax burdens compares with other states over time. This particular slide is interesting. It illustrates a downward trend in tax rates. That's the black dot, the black line with little dots, ending in fiscal year 03-04. And it shows that the tax rate ends with a tax rate of about $15 per thousand of assessed value. There was a bump there, as you can see, in 1990. You can see that until 1997-98, real and assessed values, the red and the blue lines, moved, you know, together. They were actually assessed. Assessors assessed property at real market values. And both were rising steadily over time. After 95-96, both real and assessed values continued to increase, but at different rates because of one of the measures that John will be talking to you about. During this period, tax rates were very variable, very variable. But they began to rise steadily between 1980 and 1990, as you can see on the graph. During this decade, tax rates, as I said, rose steadily, and the combination of higher assessed values and higher tax rates caused property taxes to grow at about an annual average rate of about 11%. Although today this growth rate may seem a little high to you, you have to recall that at that time the nation was burdened with, you know, double-digit inflation at one point as high as 18%. And that is, and therefore, many taxing districts actually may have needed a growth rate of 11% just to keep their level of services the same. Nonetheless, in 1991 and 97, Oregonians felt the pressure of rising taxes, and they adopted two measures in those measure each in those 2 years that constrained local authorities from raising their property taxes. These measures will be discussed, as I said, by John. However, the slide presented here reveals the effectiveness of the two measures. You can see in 1990, the average property tax rate for the state plummeted, and by 1996, real market values began to diverge from assessed values. Okay. The interesting thing is that property taxes, as the slide, as a percent of, okay. This slide is an interesting one, I think, because it gives you certain measures that are used by economists to look at the burden of tax. The first I like the best is per capita. It's not per capita. It's the red histogram that shows what property taxes were as a share of personal income. And let's say that the graph shows taxes as a percentage of personal income had been rising year after year until 1991. By 91, property taxes absorbed about 4.9% of personal income. And the statewide average at this point was about $26 per thousand of taxable assessed value. After voters, I guess you could say there was a trend here that would be alarming to many taxpayers if they did not look at, that was alarming to many taxpayers. After voters approved Measure 5 in 91, property taxes as share of income declined until 1995-96, at which point taxes absorbed only about 3.2% of personal income. And the tax rates, M5 limited tax rates, but it also took the limits for education down from what had been $15 per thousand down to about $5 per thousand over a period of 5 years, $2.50 per year. Okay. The average tax rate stood at an all-time low of $13.2 per thousand at the end of that five-year period. When voters approved Measure 50 in 1997, assessed values were rolled back substantially, but tax rates were increased over the prior year by about 11%. At this time, property taxes accounted for about 3.1% of personal income. And the average tax rate was about 14.8 per $1,000 of assessed value. Since 1997, property taxes as a share of personal income have been increasing very slowly. By FY2003, the share had increased to about 3.7%. And in 93-94, it's about 3.3%. The interesting thing, though, is that this particular indicator is a very good indicator because people generally think in terms of how much disposable income they have. And so if the tax rate is moving sort of, if their burden, the burden of tax, measured as share of income, is declining, they actually feel better off. If it stays the same, they're revenue neutral, although the actual dollars, right, in nominal terms, not deflated, but in nominal terms, may be actually increasing. Now, the second line, which is that per capita taxes per capita, is rising, as you can see, and that kind of, you know, contradicts the notion of falling tax burden. But I noticed after I had put this slide together that actually both of the first histogram relates income, taxes to income, and it doesn't have to be deflated because you're dealing with dollars to dollars. But when you look at the second graph, which is the dotted line, you're talking about income per, or taxes per capita per person in the state. And those numbers are not deflated. Those are in nominal terms. If had they been deflated, I think it would have been much flatter. Okay, so that upward trend really is really just reflecting the maybe inflation.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question of Mary. Two-part question. Mary, based upon what you're saying for the fiscal year 03-04, that's approaching $1,000 for every man, woman, and child in the state of Oregon. Are we collecting then the counties, the 36 counties, are collecting $3.3 billion of property tax somewhere? $1,000 times 3.3 million.
You're collecting. It's $3.6 billion in the aggregate.
$3.6 billion.
Right.
And that per year?
Per year.
Mr. Chair, follow-up question then. So then, and I don't know exactly that the rates are 10 cents and 5 cents for local government and schools, but can we assume then that some approximately one-third of the $3.6 billion or $1.2 billion would go into education somewhere, community college or into...
Well, we'll break that down in
okay.
a little bit.
Thank you. Thank
anything
you.
Else? Any more?
That's it. Thank you.
Yes.
Just for clarification, when you say per capita, and you said per person a minute ago, and a lot of course, businesses pay property taxes too. How is that? What's the methodology there?
I haven't broken down the data by type of taxpayer. Okay, there are several documents that we've given you though that will break down. I believe it's in the Department of Revenue's document that breaks down property taxes in terms of commercial, residential and whatever, so that you see what shares of taxes are being paid by different segments. We haven't done that in this presentation, but it is in that document, the one.
Okay. Great, thanks.
Anything else? Any points?
It is relatively hard to try to keep the presentation up to an aggregate level, and we try once in a while to come down to show you a little more detail. But the presentation could get very complicated and lengthy if we went down. So we brought a lot of these documents with us. The LRO document and the Department of Revenue document will take, and I'll mention at times when I show you something at the state level, I'll show you, tell you what table you can go to actually find county level data. All right, this is the last slide, really, that I wanted to show you for part one, and I think it's very, very reflective of the improvement in property taxes in, almost the last slide, I should say, but this is a ranking of property taxes by state, across states, for the last, 20-some years. The rankings are, as you can see, based on income and per capita, taxes per capita. Notice in 1990-91, Oregon's tax version measured a ranking of 6. Now, 6 in this case is very high. In other words, it's a high burden of tax relative to the other states in the nation. Then I think you can see as property tax has decreased because of the measures 5 and 50, you'll see how much less the burden was. Today, or as of 1990-99, you've got a burden there of about 25% of income, and this really is about a midpoint for, which is substantial, which is a substantial improvement over the last 20 years. Finally, there's a few slides that I've added here that really are just more for your information than anything else. And you'll see the first is just a ranking. It's a table that you can find in table B1 of the department's current report. And it ranks, it lists the assessed value of taxes by county and shows you that almost 46% of assessed value in Oregon is in three counties, They're labeled on the graph there in blue. I think they include Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties. And then you see about 24% or 25% covered by the yellow, you know, are covered by another, you know, four counties. And then you've got nine counties that take up about 9%, and the remainder, which leaves about 20%, is covered by about 25 counties. So there's a huge spread in the assessed value, the variability of that. Property taxes, the last slide, I guess, shows you, and there's an error here, so please correct your handouts, but not the slide is correct. These are property tax rates measured as dollars per $1,000. I erred as I was typing in these changes. I still have one there which has a percentage, and the percentages shouldn't be there. These are dollars per thousand of assessed value. And you can see from that slide that property taxes in FY03-04 ranged from between $8.9 per thousand in Cook County, I believe it is, to about $20 in Multnomah County. The average and median tax rates as percentages of assessed value were about $14 per thousand. And the LRO current report that is available over on the side table there has more of this detail for you in table D5, and it compares them across FY203 as well. For example, some rates increased. You can see this in table D5 in that other report, the LRO report, that some rates increased between a tenth of a percent to 8%, while in other counties, 13 counties, rates actually declined between a tenth of a percent and as much as 2.5% in Tillamook County.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Butler.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, Mary, I'm confused, and I'm sure there's a very easy explanation for it. The with Measure 5, the rates are capped at 1.5, and if I'm looking at this correct, there's some that go as high as 16.5 and 20.
They're capped on real market value, aren't they? So as a percent of assessed value, you can actually have a rate that's higher than what, but they're all. Go ahead, John.
Mr. Chair, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue and members of the committee. I think what you're seeing there, Representative Butler, is the addition of the bond rates, the non-included rates. They're not subject to the five or the $10 limit.
Okay, point.
Oh,
yeah,
okay. Thank you. All right, in summary then, for this section, I just wanted to conclude by telling you what we think are the major points. Over the past 20 years, assessed values of property taxes varied substantially. Inflation and voters' reactions to increases in property taxes contributed to the variability. Voter approval of Measure 5 in 1990 or 91 marked the end of a long period of rising tax rates, ending with $24 per thousand of real market value. By FY03-04, that statewide average stands at roughly 15.6 per thousand of assessed value and 11.42 per thousand of real market value. Voter approval of Measure 50 in 1970 marked the end of a long period of rising property assessments that were driven by market values. Remember that graph where the real and assessed value began to diverge. The combination of Measures 5 and 50 constraints stabilized the pattern of growth in property taxes. The property tax burden in FY90-91, measured as tax divided by personal income, reached a high point of 4.9% in that year. But since 97, property taxes as a percent of personal income have remained below 3.5%. Compared with other states, between 1991 and a decade later, Oregon's ranking with respect to property tax burden has declined substantially. That is, in 90, early in the decade, property taxes as a percentage of personal income is lower relative to its rank of 25, which had been what it was early in the decade. In 03-04, assessed values per county ranged between $76 million and $43 billion. That was the dispersion there in what's the value of property. 50% of the county's assessed values were above $3.09 billion. Tax rates per county ranged between $8.89 and $20 per thousand. 50% of tax rates were above.
Just one question relative to that property tax or property values that you'd mentioned, Mary. Is that as to all taxable property, or is that as to all fair market value of property, including exempt and publicly owned property?
All taxable.
All taxable property only. Thank you.
Right. Okay. All right. That concludes this section, and we're right on schedule. Okay. We'll start this section, Section 2, that deals with presentation, describes the types of property that are subject to property tax. It does not cover every exemption, but these can be found in the DOR's 205 Tax Expenditure Report. Okay. It focuses, presentation in this part of the focuses primarily on the tax structure. That is, I'll illustrate shortly that property taxes are labeled in several ways because some types of taxes are designed for operations, while others for construction and infrastructure, capital projects, and still others are targeted or earmarked for special purposes, such as urban renewal. Some of these tax categories are subject to more legislative constraints than others, which is why they're defined differently, and we call that the structure, okay, of the property tax taxes. Part 2 ends with an overview that John will present of Measures 5 and 50, which I've shown you in Part 1 just how much of an impact those measures had on reducing the tax burden, property tax burden in Oregon. I'll also include some examples, after which you'll be tested. No, I'm serious. Some examples of how to fill out a tax statement and how the concept of compression really shows you how interrelated a lot of taxing districts are. They act independently, but in a sense they don't. Because of these measures 5 and 50, they are related to one another, and we'll show you how that works with the concept of compression. What property is taxed? First of all, real property and personal property are taxed. Real property includes land itself and all buildings and equipment. It includes personal property, which means all movable possessions, merchandise, furniture, livestock, vehicles, tools, and equipment. And some properties, such as vehicles that are not purchased by motor vehicle departments, are exempt, and personal property for personal use is also exempt. Generally, there are some exceptions, but intangible personal property, such as stocks and bonds, contracts, they're not taxable. Intangible property, you know, is an economic resource, but it has no physical presence. In this graph, you'll see, I apologize, I've mislabeled the numbers, but not the actual graph. When you look at the numbers, you'll see property type, and the first type should be real property, not residential. And this table is really duplicating some information that you'll find in Table A. Actually, it's 4A, page 14 of the DOR's report, where this information can be reviewed at the county level, where here I'm just trying to keep it at the state level. And you can see in this report that real property accounted for 92% of property values in 03-04, and it reflected a growth rate of about 8% over the prior year. Probably reflecting a surge in home construction construction and the low interest rates that we've seen for the last few years. Personal property reflected a growth rate of about 2.5%, slower than growth in real property. And again, I can only opinionate here on this, but because we've been going through a recession, some of the personal property that is buildings, or not buildings, but equipment, machinery, I think some of the businesses have been waiting for a recovery, and they now can take advantage of, you know, I think they delayed in taking advantage of the accelerated amortization schedule, and they may be doing that now, but that may have slowed down the rate of growth in personal property. We'll switch a second graph, very similar to the first, is just simply assessed value, but you can recall from the first this one of the presentations in the first slide, how real values and market assessed values diverged. Mm-hmm. So there are some slight differences. Assessed value for real property equals about 90% of total amount of assessed value and grew at about 6.3% over the past 5 years. That's less than the 8% in real market values. Personal property grew about equals about 3.7% of value and grew at about a 2.6% rate. Public utilities equal about 4.9% of assessed value and grew at an average rate of about 4.2%. And public utilities are grew at about the same rate as real property values, or real public utilities, and these are centrally assessed, are they not? Okay, there you have a comparison of the two graphs that I just showed you, real versus assessed value, and the differences in growth will be affected by measures 5 and 50 and the concept of compression that we'll show you about in a minute. We'll illustrate in the next section that the importance of accurate valuation of assessed values is important, I should say, because new construction and improvements must be added to tax rolls based on the ratio of assessed value to real market value in a particular neighborhood. So you can see here that statewide, the ratio of assessed value to real market value is like about 74%. Why this is important? Well, if you constructed a new home in a particular neighborhood and your assessor had to put a value on that for tax purposes, the market value of, say, a home might be $200,000, but he can't put that value on the roll at $200,000. He has to put that on the roll relative to what this ratio is in the neighborhood in which that property is located. And I believe the same thing applies to additions, doesn't it? So if you have a house that's worth $100,000 or $200,000 and you put on a new garage that was worth market value $50,000, it would be put on $200,000 is your assessed value plus 74% of the value of the $50,000 garage. Correct. So that's why the work of the county appraisers to put value on the rolls and to calculate the accuracy of the assessments and the relative and the real market values is important for that reason.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
A couple of questions with regard to the discussion of what property is taxed in this rate. Is the 74.4% a uniform AV to RV throughout the state?
This is just the ratio across statewide. But it varies by smaller areas,
county,
correct?
County by county.
County by county.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I noticed back on an earlier statement here, just before, as to what property is taxed, that the real tangible property, including land and buildings and the new structures erected upon it, and then tangible personal property means all movable possessions, merchandise, furniture, livestock, vehicles, tools, and equipment. Is there a property tax on livestock and inventory?
Not on retail inventory, but that's what was in the form.
Yeah.
Livestock or livestock. This lists livestock as a taxable personal property. It says personal property that is taxed. I'm questioning.
I'd have to check that, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. I do know we have some intangible retail, right? And retail inventories are not taxed because we reviewed that slightly a few weeks ago. Yeah. I'll have to check on that.
Thank you. And follow up, Mr. Chair, the issue of the livestock is of interest to me as well. I think timber and farm equipment, and I could be wrong with regard to the timber equipment, but that's, I think some of that is exempt as well. And I would like to have, because we have local government asking how they could raise additional resources, I would like to have maybe just a little research done on the issue. Maybe, John, this is something you could help through the department. the issue of taxation of the merchandise inventory. Local governments, it's my understanding, there's no preclusion from local governments charging a merchandise inventory tax.
Right.
I would like to have some additional information about that, and then that's not reported anywhere at this particular time, so I'm going to guess that if City X wanted to charge on inventories, they could charge up to 1%. I'd like to know also if the school districts could charge their 0.5% at that point, too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, in terms of the question on livestock, I believe there's a specific statute on that, and I don't have total recall on that, but the other elements in this tangible personal property, furniture, merchandise, possessions, those are non-personal items in your household. They only relate to business property. So if you in your house have furniture, that would not be taxable as tangible personal property. But if a business, like a law office or some kind of a business, had furniture in their office or computers and data systems, that would be considered tangible personal property. The question about inventory is specifically exempt from taxation. And that I believe there's a specific exemption for that item, and so that would I believe that would require legislation to change that. I don't think it's at the option of the local government to decide to tax that. The local governments don't have authority on the state property tax to decide to tax or not to tax something on their own. It's a state's property tax system.
Mr. Chair, I'd like some definitive discussion about that issue, because while I'm not advocating more taxes, I think that we need to give local governments their maximum flexibility locally. But if it is in fact a state statute that merchandise for resale is not taxable under any event, then we can either go there or not, depending upon the wish of the committee. And finally, the reason that they do not tax me for my home furniture is, years ago when we got out of college, we decorated an early depression, and we kind of stayed that direction. So nobody wants it. Not even the dumpster will take it away.
Fully appreciate it.
Mr. Chair,
would you like them to bring you back some information of this committee back? So
okay.
Would you do so?
Yes.
Now, the one thing that I'm really disturbed here is the way the market values go as per assessed values in the state. What you're telling me is I can build a $200,000 house, put it in a neighborhood that has $100,000 houses, and have to take the average in that particular surroundings to determine the value of that $200,000 house? Is that what you're telling me?
No, it's the addition to that $200,000 house. If you were to put, if you had a $200,000 house that was assessed at $200,000, and you decided...
Well, it's new construction.
And you added a new... Well, if it were a new construction and it were $200,000, it would go on at the ratio for that community. Yeah.
For the particular neighborhood or
right.
the community itself. So theoretically, what I'm saying is correct. Okay. Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If I may, just to follow up on what he's saying, we know that any new house that's built is valued to some degree on its location. And so the same house in different neighborhoods, even though it's exactly the same built house, will have a different value. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Representative.
Thank you.
All right, we'll continue on here with the discussion of the property tax structure. There are major components. We'll talk about the characteristics of the permanent rate, local option election, and three other major other components of the tax structure. The permanent local rate is established by Measure 50, and it's based on a levy amount that supplements local budgetary needs. It also generates most of the taxes, property taxes. That's why local option bonds our property taxes collected to repay indebtedness on bonds that are issued for long-term capital projects. These are your two major sources of property taxes. Permanent rates. Existing local taxing districts cannot exceed or increase their permanent rates. However, some districts did not get a permanent rate in the M5 calculation, and other districts have spun off some services, and their rates have not changed. Moreover, some districts, a district may choose to impose a rate that is less than the permanent rate. So when we go through some examples later, you'll see, you know, what happens when someone decides to use its full authority. Okay. And it hasn't been doing so in the past. Non-schools can impose less than the full tax rate authority. New taxing districts can establish permanent rates. Merging districts would set a rate to raise the same total revenue. In other words, it has to be revenue neutral. And existing rates extended onto annexed property. We just talked about that. General obligation bond debt. This is debt that is exempt from the M5 limits. And we'll talk about that when we go through the tax example. Tax statement example. They must be approved in a general election or get 50% turnout in order to get approved. Can be a five-year bond for public safety vehicles. General obligation bonds cannot be used for the following: reasonably anticipated maintenance and repairs or supplies and equipment that aren't intrinsic to structure. Three other components that do not comprise a lot of the total amount of taxes collected are gap bonds. Among them, there's three others. The first is gap bonds, which are debt obligations that were unable to be rolled up into the Measure 50 17% reduction. This may seem a little confusing because John hasn't done his presentation yet, but I will say that Measure 50 rolled back assessed values. And in principle, if at that point in time you'd been a jurisdiction that had higher assessed value, high assessed values, and you had basically issued some bonds that were supported by the taxes from that revenue, when Measure 50 rolled back that assessed value, you would have come up short in your revenues. And so basically there was an allowance made there. Is that correct? That works. Now, when my feeling there then is that since this was a one-time only event, these gap bonds are just something that should eventually decline over time in importance. Okay. Urban renewal bonds are property taxes collected to repay indebtedness on bonds issued by urban renewal bonding agencies. Local option taxes are additional tax rates that are imposed for special purposes for 5 to 10 years. Characteristics of a local option: they're levies outside the permanent rate limit. They can additional rate, but they must be approved in a general election or election with a 50% turnout. They're operating levies. Operating levies are limited to 5 years. But capital levies, that is investments in capital improvements, are limited to the lesser of useful life or 10 years. The levies may be a rate or a levy based, or levy based, and are subject to Measure 5. When I say these words subject to Measure 5, it may seem confusing at first, but when we go, that's why I thought it would be important to go through a little tax statement to see how that, what that means. Okay. The school local option is in 1999, HB 2753 allowed K-12 districts to seek voter approval of local option taxes. And 17 local school districts have received voter approval for local options beginning in 2001. Also, since Measure 50, community colleges could ask voters for local options, but I haven't seen anything in the report that show that they've actually exercised that authority at this point. I'll show you some data in a minute. You will not see that they've collected any monies from exercising that local authority. Finally, before I end and John begins, I wanted to add this last slide just to give you a concept of the layering involved in the property tax structure in Oregon. Because, as I said earlier, Each taxing district has certain authority, but they have to, at some point or another, interact with one another because they have constraints imposed on the total amount that can be levied with per account. And so you'll see that the account level in this pyramid that's shown here shows you the account level at the bottom of the pyramid where Measure 5 has to be imposed. And then there are other areas where I believe with urban renewal there's some restriction imposed on code area. I may not be sure about that, but the pyramiding is there to illustrate that Measures 5 and 50 have to be, or Measures 5, I should say, are imposed at the account level. And at that, and we'll show you what that means shortly after John finishes his presentation.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question, Mary, and I may be missing it, relative to the general obligation bonds and the bonded debt. The information characteristics of local option, and I read that there's both urban gap bonds, urban renewal bonds, and local option taxes, but that the characteristics of the local option tax is that, that with regard to capital levies, they're limited to the lesser of the useful life or 10 years. That certainly wouldn't be the case with regard to a school. I didn't see, because school bonds could be much longer than 10 years, could they not?
On local option, I don't believe so. Correct. The general obligation bonds can be much longer, right? But your local option authority is have limited time frames.
So the GO bonds, the GO bonds are not they're not limited by this characteristics of local option taxes.
Correct.
Then, okay. So those could be, and I just didn't see that discussion as to the life of the GO bonds.
I may not have mentioned that. I apologize, Mr.
No, that's fine. So those could be for 20, 30 years even.
Certainly.
For the construction of a new courthouse or the construction of a new city hall or the construction of a new school building.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, John Phillips. And I'd like to cover just a few of the highlights of measures 5 and 50. It is the ongoing impact of these constitutional measures on the flexibility of the property tax is quite significant. It has a lot to do with the certainties embedded in the process for taxpayers, for property owners, and it also has to do with the limitations on the legislature and local governments in changing the provisions. Most of Article 11 of the Constitution is a summary of Measures 5 and 50. First year of implementation for Measure 5 was 91 and 92, and as Paul pointed out the other day in his presentation, rates were high. We were number 7, Oregon, in the nation for property taxes, and the reaction to that October bill that he mentioned was a ballot measure on the 89 November ballot, and that passed, and it gave us Measure 5. That year, there were a handful of rates in the state that were from between the total rates for the districts on any given property. There were a total of a handful of them that ranged between $29 and $32 per thousand as a consolidated tax rate. So if your property and you happen to be in that area, you were facing a rate that high. There was one county in the state which had an average tax rate of $37 per thousand. So this is what taxpayers were looking at when they voted on Measure 5. That same county whose average tax rate was $37 in 1989, this past year had an average tax rate of $15. So, and as the slide Mary pointed out, showing the assessed values and the taxable values going down, highly illustrated that point. All of the properties in a code area, which are like combinations of districts, require one calculation of tax. But because these limits of Measure 5 were applied to each property, the limit was effective on each particular property, the assessor then, following Measure 5, had to do a separate special calculation on every property tax account to extend the tax rates and then compress the tax rates down to the $5 and the $10 limits. So it did bring some complexity, additional complexity to the system. In some counties, that meant simply reprogramming their computers. This was back in 1990. And in some counties, it actually forced the county assessor to purchase a computer. Yeah. The next slide And I'm absolutely serious about that.
I'm ready to move.
On the next slide, we're just looking at the phased-in rate for school was $5 per thousand. And again, as Mary mentioned, that started out as a $15 per thousand for schools, $10 per thousand for general government, and that was phased in over 5 years, reduced $2.50 per year. So when you see the slide that she showed earlier with it dropping significantly over a five-year period, that's that $2.50 per thousand per year drop, phasing in that rate.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a question with regard to the thank you, Mr. Chair. A question regarding the RMV here as it's used. The so if I'm paying my tax on AV, the assessed value, all this time I thought the $15 applied to the assessed value, not the real market value. Using the example that was just given just a moment ago, that I put $200,000 home in a $100,000 home neighborhood. End up with a $200,000 home is the real market value. I just put that much money into it. So the tax, even though the assessed value might be $100,000, the tax could be $3,000 on that home based upon the real market value?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, under Measure 5, the real market value was the assessed value. It was one and the same, and there was no distinction because the assessed value concept came in. While people use that term,
okay.
The assessed value concept really came in with Measure 50 in 1997. There was a conscious decision at that point to leave the Measure 5 rate limits at the real market value. And so you can end up with a higher assessed value rate, an effective rate that's higher, but it's all a function of how the $15 compares to the real market value.
Mr. Chair, I think I've recognized the error of my way. This slide is limited to a discussion of Measure 5 limits before Measure 50. Thank you.
Measure 5 also briefly required all taxes that were property taxes to be billed on the tax statement. And it did not allow any taxes that weren't property taxes to be billed on the tax statement. So it sort of focused everything because there was an anticipation that charges might be become an idea for a local government, and they might put that on the tax statement and then try not to get it subject to, you know, not that local governments would do that, but I'm just saying there was the possibility that all these doors were closed so that everything was subject to the $5 and the $10 limits. Because Measure 5 was a limit on the tax rates and values really began to drive the actual tax burden, the Measure 50, the people that were behind the concepts of Measure 50 developed Measure 47, which was introduced back in November of 96. As Paul mentioned the other day, and Mary has said, that by May of 1997, the legislature decided to craft a measure put before the voters to fix some of the complexities and some of the contradictions that were inherent in Measure 47. It was extremely difficult to put into practice, and so it was rewritten, but in order to gain approval and to bring people together to coalesce around this idea of Measure 50, they retained the Measure 5 limits that I just talked about. They retained the property tax reduction, the cut and the cap, if you will, the cut of taxes back, which Mary referred to as a rollback, and the cap, which is the limit on the growth of assessed value. All of this had to go into a formula that was called a black box, which the Revenue Committee was keenly aware of at that time, because all of the property taxes had to be calculated twice in Oregon that year. And tax statements, if you'll remember, were mailed in December instead of October that year in most counties because of the inability of the assessors and the Department of Revenue to get the calculation done between the passage of the measure in May and the actual implementation that fall. There have been four constitutional ballot measures since that time to amend Measure 50. Two of them dealt with the double majority vote requirements, and one of them, and two others, and all four of them have failed. That's why I mentioned earlier that the fact that most of these provisions for the property tax are in the Constitution, it has limited the ability to be flexible with its provisions. I want to talk just briefly about the maximum assessed value. If we think about the rollback, this is the value that was established as the limit on the taxable amount of your value. This was the part that Measure 5 had missed. And so they said, the drafters said, we're going to roll the values back, the taxable value, back to 1995-96, and then we're going to subtract 10% from that. That's going to be the maximum assessed value. So when you see the term MAV, that's what I'm referring to, the maximum assessed value. They also recognized that not only was their property existing in 1997, but that there might be new property in the future. That new property then would make it extremely difficult to roll that property value sometime in the future, 2005, 2006, back to the 1995-96 value and subtract 10%. And so they created this changed property ratio. And this ratio was to deal with new property following the implementation year. So on your tax statement, you're going to see real market value, which, as there's been discussion already, the value of the home might be $200,000. That's the real market value. That's the value in the Constitution that two willing parties in an arm's length transaction would agree to transact the property for. The maximum assessed value is the rolled back value. It's sort of the ceiling, the guaranteed level above which you won't be taxed. The assessed value is the value you're actually taxed on, and it's the lesser of the two. So it did anticipate the fact that property values don't always go up. Sometimes they will go down. So when the market experiences a downtrend, the taxable amount of that property will be the lower of the two. And the reason why there's a little bit of a complicated formula, as you'll see in this slide, 103% versus 100%, what that does is it ensures that there's the potential for growth of 3% every year, but it also anticipates a down market and freezes the maximum assessed value in the case where the real market is actually below the maximum assessed. So instead of the maximum assessed continuing to increase at 3%, there is a point in time at which it will freeze and level out until such time as the real market value goes up and above that.
Mr. Chair.
It's a floor.
Yes, Representative Riley.
So what you're saying is that it will never, the assessed value will never go down, even though the real market value might plunge.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, no, what I'm saying is that it can go down, but when the real market value goes up above where the maximum assessed value has been frozen, it won't shock the property owner all the way up just because of something the market decided to do. We have had some counties, I know Curry County's had some downtrends in the real market value, and all of a sudden something might occur to that county or a property that makes the real market value jump extremely high, and in that year the property owner, but for that frozen value, would experience a 20 or a 30% increase, and so it was designed to be a sort of a shock valve.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help?
What I'm referring to, and maybe you answered it, but I didn't understand it, but if I'm paying, if my assessed value is $100,000 and my real market value goes below $100,000, the assessed value does not decrease to that new value. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Riley, no. The assessed value would be the lesser in any given year of the maximum assessed or the real market value. So in such a case as the real market value diving below the maximum assessed, you would be taxed in that year on the lesser of the two, which would be the real market.
Thank you.
Yes. It is a complicated concept. Because we have this limitation on growth and this rollback, the drafters also recognize that there might be some circumstances in which there should be an exception to these limitations. And we've identified five exceptions here that are actually enunciated in the Constitution. New construction is a little broader than just that. It could be a new building. It could be new property, as in new personal property. And then there's a situation where property is subdivided, if you have a 20-acre parcel, it's worth, let's say, $100,000. I'm just throwing out a number. Then you subdivide it into 20 one-acre lots, could be worth four times that much. That particular owner benefits from the additional value because they may turn around and sell it, but they should also have an adjusted taxable value corresponding to that change in the value of that property for those purposes. Another change would be admitted property, and that's a term in the statute that is for property that's unknown to the assessor. It's newly discovered. Sometimes this is like, I don't know if you've ever known anyone who's built a house or built a garage, put on an addition, and they have not gotten a permit for that. I've heard that sometimes this happens. And
no way.
And this is the situation where the assessor could then add additional taxable value for that, and it's an exception.
What is it?
Sounds like a problem.
And then there's loss of exemption in the case where you are doing something that the legislature has determined to be a valuable thing to do, like you run a church, and so you shouldn't be taxed on the church. If you discontinue using that church for church purposes or any special assessment or exemption, and you come out of that special assessment or exemption because you've changed the use, then you would be subject to have your taxable value set at that point. The key with the exception value is that if the assessor is not catching exception value, it's direct lost revenue for the taxing districts, and it's also lost indefinitely. So there's a real pressure on the county assessors and the appraisers that work for them to get out there and get this assessed value on the roll. Just briefly, minor construction was a concept that the drafters did not want assessors going out and picking up the new deck. They thought that there should be some threshold for new property, and so they said, we don't want assessors going out and picking up new decks. We want something substantial, so they set a $10,000 limit to that and or $25,000 over 5 years. I'll just give you a quick example of the new property. This is a little bit of a busy slide, but down the right side you'll see three properties, and we'll just use residential for this example. Three properties, they already exist. Each of them has a real market value. Each of them has an assessed value. There's a new home created, and it's worth $150,000 of real market value. The assessor then takes this ratio that Mary explained earlier, and it's the average ratio of assessed to real market value. And this, by statute, is it's a county-wide average. So the assessor would look at all residential property county-wide, develop this ratio, apply it to the real market value, that's the value the home would sell for, in their estimation. They'd apply this ratio, and that would become the maximum assessed value for that property. That's how all new property is treated, whether it's commercial, industrial, utility, personal property, or residential.
Yes, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's countywide assessed value. In this case, we were talking about residential. So there is a ratio for residential, there'd be a ratio for commercial, a ratio for industrial, a ratio for personal property, did you say? I'm looking for a ratio. How about vacant lots, commercial? How many ratios will any county have maximum?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I believe, and I don't have full recollection on this, but I believe that there's unimproved and improved residential. It is broken down into some subcategories, but I could get to that information.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Each one of them has a separate ratio, an AV?
Yes, Representative Butler.
Thank you.
Do they not also countywide? When you say countywide, that's like comparing apples and an apple with an orange, as far as I'm concerned, because you can have specific locations within a community that will be substantially different than the countywide average, and that's what we're talking about here is the countywide average. What do we have different classifications? Example: let's take the one at the top compared to the ranch style in the middle. Countywide, they aren't comparing those two, or trying to, are they? They have different classifications for the one at the top and the one in the middle?
Mr. Chair, the property does have classes. There are classes that are assigned to each, you know, residential property, for example. Like that might be a Class 1 home, Class 2, Class 3. There's different classes that appraisers use to actually assign value, real market value to those properties. But the classes for which the changed property ratio is created is in our Department of Revenue rule, and it sets out more major categories like residential, commercial, the ones that Representative Butler has enunciated, yes. And there is a great variation, but a decision in 97 was, is do we want the assessors to create, you know, how many do we want them to create? Because sometimes some counties are more homogeneous than others, or there's pockets of homogeneity, and so there's a question about, well, to what extent do we want them to go to that effort?
Representative Berger.
I'm so confused sometimes I can't even form the question correctly.
Sorry.
Did I understand that the ratio stays the same within a county?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, Vice Chair Berger, the ratio changes year to year, but it is the same countywide.
Exactly. Okay. I think I got the right answer I was looking for, so I think I must have asked the question.
I did check, in this particular year, the ratio for residential across the state, improved and unimproved, ranged from 0.64, which is 64% relative relationship, to 0.91. And that's, and I didn't look to see which counties those were, but that just gives you kind of a range. Typically, what you'll see for personal property, most industrial property, and almost and all utility property will be a ratio of 1. So in the case of those properties, the real market and the assessed value are the same, and that is because you have a depreciating asset replaced with new property, and it continually makes the real market value be the assessed value. So that tends to be the case.
That's too cute to ask a
question. I'm sure Representative Butler understands that quite well.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, I'm so glad to have that clarified.
I apologize.
I'm sorry.
Well,
I was
proud of
those comments. Okay, moving along. I think I just got two left here. I just want to move to levy authority because we've talked a lot about values, but in terms of levy authority, it was also a significant change from Measure 50, and that was that it rolled up all levy authority. You may remember what a tax base was. You might have heard of a tax base. That was an amount that the district had that was authorized by the voters that could increase annually by 6% in the Constitution.
Right.
That was eliminated. There were serial levies. There were millage levies. There were historical levies. They were all rolled up into one authority and converted to a rate following its reduction. So all of that went away. Some of the dedication of that revenue went away, and it was rolled up in the general fund of the taxing district. Mary talked a little bit about gap bonds, and they're kind of a thing that's going away, so I won't spend too much time on that. We'll go to the next slide. Calculation looks very simple on this page, and it's not. And I won't go into detail because there's some more slides we need for you. So we'll just talk about the calculation. And okay, that's fine. You remember the other day we had a discussion about how complicated income taxes were and how it takes a CPA. You actually hire a CPA in most cases to calculate them for you because it's very difficult. Fortunately, we have 36 county assessors that do this calculation for us. So we'd be very thankful that they're there doing their job because it is a complicated process. There's over 1,500 taxing districts with multiple levies. There's millions of accounts, just over 2 million accounts, just approximately. Several thousand, I mentioned, taxing districts, hundreds of tax expenditures. I think it was about 117, I should say, last I checked, tax expenditures like exemptions, special assessments, etc. And all of this has to come down to the individual account and be calculated, and then the taxes have to be compressed. So it's quite a complex process. And that covers the rollback of the taxes, the limit on the growth, the consolidation of the levy authority and how the limits of Measure 5 are still imposed on each property on each tax rate.
Just summarizing this section of the presentation, real and personal property are taxed between 2002 and 2003. Real value, real market value, and assessed value grew by about 7.4% and 5.9% respectively. Assessed value of real property represents about 90% of the property tax base, and between these 2 years, assessed value of real property grew by 6.3%. Real market value grew by 8%. Revenue derived from permanent rate taxes and general obligation bonds accounted for about 88% of local property taxes in the FY 03-04. Revenues grew by totaling $3.6 billion, grew about 5.76% over the prior year. And in 03-04, local option taxes for city and K-12 taxing districts grew about 155% and 59% over the prior year. Measure 5 limits are in effect on all property. Measure 50 created an artificial value ceiling. Measure 50 limits the annual growth of that ceiling. Measure 50 consolidated levy authority. Measure 50 restricts the options for new levy authority, and double majority voter approval applies to all local government levy requests outside the general election. Measure 5 limits are in effect on all property. Going back again? Okay.
There you go.
We had scheduled about a 1.5 hour presentation for you, and the third part of this presentation will move rather quickly because we would like to be finished by 3 o'clock, and I appreciate your attention. It's very complicated, but we're going to go through in this section. We want to try to give you a few examples so that we can bring all of these concepts together. Measure 5, how does it work? How does it affect your tax rate? Why are taxing districts, interrelated in a financial way? So let's start that by taking a look first at who levies taxes on property, what the distribution of property taxes are by type of tax and taxing district. We'll take a look at components of a tax statement. We'll take a look at urban renewal rather quickly, and we'll just add another example of a tax statement that shows urban renewal added to the tax statement. In 2003-04, Oregon had more than 1,500 taxing districts categorized as educational and government. School districts comprised of K-12, community colleges, and educational special districts accounted for 45% roughly of property tax collections. Cities and counties accounted for about 40%. Urban renewal and special districts accounted for 14%. In that 14%, urban renewal accounted for about 4%. Not all local districts have taxing authority, though. Which one? Here's a graph that you can find duplicated in the LRO current report, table D2, that will give you some percentages, but I'll just highlight what we have here. The K-12s account for the largest share of property taxes collected statewide, almost $1.43 billion, according to this table. $1.43 billion for K-12s, another $207 million for ESDs and community colleges. The largest source of revenue for schools in FY 03-04 was taxes from that permanent rate authority that we discussed earlier. It totaled 73% of their revenues. Cities and counties collected $1.46 billion, or 40.5% of property taxes. Collections from permanent rate authority accounted for 79% of those taxes. However, it's interesting that in 03-04, revenues from exercising local option authority increased over 100% for cities and counties, which explains why they had a healthy 9% increase over the prior year. Urban renewal, as I said earlier, accounted for about 4%, and special districts, 10%. Here's just a pictorial display of how educational taxes for education have declined in relative terms. They've grown, as we just said, in absolute dollars, but considering back what
the educational districts had back in 95-96 before that rollback, they've been severely cut in relative terms, and they haven't been able to make a comeback since. Components of a tax statement. This is where I'd like to hopefully bring a lot of this, these pieces of information together for you. Okay. Tax statement has, you know, the tax number and code area. It identifies each taxpayer. Code area identifies the unique combination of taxing districts that service a particular account. So if Representative Riley and Representative Comp lived in one code area, you would have different taxing districts serving you than, let's say, Representative Vice Chair Representative Berger, who might be in a different code area. Okay. However, okay, we go on to like the basics of a. Just we all know this. We've covered this, but here's the property tax bill. A very simplistic property tax bill. You'll notice the information at the top we just covered. You'll notice that the area colored in blue pertains to educational districts that are subject to the Measure 5 limit of $5 per thousand of real market value. So your actual assessed rate could be higher than 5, but not higher than $5 per thousand real market value. And then you have, in this example, a collection of $750. We don't know what the implied rate is. The effective rate here is K-12 school district, $575 in this example. If you wanted to find out what it is, you'd divide it by the 125,000 and you'd find out what the effective tax rate was per thousand. But here we have a section that is totally independent. The educational district's M5 constraint is totally independent of the governmental restriction of $10 per $1,000 real market value. If you add up the two amounts, the 9 and the 750, 900 and 1700, you get a total tax bill of $1,650. The general obligation bonds, the tax of $125 would be on the statement, or it would be out. I don't know if it's printed there directly, but it is outside the M5 limit. So when you add up the $1,650 to see if it satisfies the M5 limit, well, you would realize that the 750 divided by the real market value of 150, because it's in per thousands, would satisfy the M5 limit. It would be roughly, it would be exactly equal to the $5 per thousand. And if you divided the 900 by 150, you'd get exactly a ratio of $6 per thousand for the governmental limit. So you'd be, in this case, both types of districts are satisfying their MFI limit. They're less than that limit. So there's no problem. There's no compression here. And the additional $125 for the bond tax is outside that constraint. Okay? So now let's just move. Yes?
Yes. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But the way that you're showing this, Mary, is that the educational tax, which is supposed to be limited to 5%, is 5% of the real market value, not of the assessed value.
It's $5 per thousand of real market value.
$5, I beg your pardon, right. $5 of which?
Of real market value.
Not of assessed value.
Not of assessed value. So it's to be higher than $5 of assessed value, right? Divide it out. Okay, so now what I'd like to do, if there's no further questions, go to a little more complicated example when it's not needed. I want to try to, for simplicity, I want to try to eliminate the educational district for the sake of just focusing on one district. And we'll just take a look at the government districts. And you'll see the same thing I just showed you, where the $900 divided by 150, which is the real market value, gives you a $6 per thousand real market rate, which is less than Measure 5, so there's no compression. Now we'll switch to example B, defining compression, which tells you you've got to bring all the taxes back to that limit, that governmental limit of $10 per thousand real market value. And here's where I think it's really fascinating. I'm coming from out of state and being new here, that all these taxing districts may operate independently, and then at some point you may find out that you've exceeded your limit. Right? So they all have to, I don't know whether they meet or act independently, but at some point you know, the bottom line is at some point those taxes, if someone has gone over the limit by imposition of a tax, here's an example B where I'm saying suppose that a county had not been using its full permanent rate authority and it decided to go up. Now, the same numbers are here, so I'm just adding to the previous example so that you can follow through what's going on in the most simplest terms. But suppose that a county has been using $325, applying that to a particular account, tax account, and it was not using its full permanent rate authority and decided, oh, I'm going to use it, and I'm going to take it up to $900, or a total of $1,225. Now, if you add across all the different taxes imposed, the only thing that changed in this example was the county taking its rate up to its full rate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now you've got an $1,800 tax bill, which we call an extended tax, but it exceeds the M5 limit, okay? And so how much has to come down? Well, it has to satisfy that $10 limit by actually chopping off $300. So how is it going to do that? It does it. And here's the interdependencies of the taxing districts for this account. There's ratios on the side, on the right-hand side of the slide, percentage out. How much of the $1,225 over the 18? How much is $1,225 over 1,800? It's 68%. You take those percentages and use those percentages in the next slide to subtract out. Look at the bottom of the table, and you'll see how much the county tax had to be compressed. It's $1,225 minus 68% of that $300 that has to come off the bill. And then you'll end up with those final numbers on the right-hand side that show you how much each taxing district is affected by the decision of the county at one point, in this example, to use its full permanent rate authority. So I'm not sure exactly how they interact with one another in order to avoid that, but you can see how, although the educational districts are separate from the governmental districts, right, at some point they all are interdependent financially. Now, I want to show you a few more slides because this is so much fun, right? let's say that the $900 increment that we just applied to the counties in that scenario were actually applied through the use of a county's applying a $450 local option tax, and a city's doing the same thing. Well, the same scenario would apply. You'd have to take off, in order to get back to the M5 limit, you'd have to take off some certain amount of money. 50% of that county, of that local option, was applicable to those two districts, and the compression would basically be applied so that you would get that back down to $1,500. All right, now this is another example where we have the county decides to use more of its permanent rate authority by adding $450, and the city decides to use the local option tax and apply $450 limit to that. In this situation, okay, which is rather interesting, the Measure 5 requires that compression be applied to the local option levies before any permanent rates are compressed. Okay? So that's rather interesting because now you have to lose that $300, but it's going to come off the city local option tax before it comes off. So in this case, $300 came right off the city tax, and the compression occurred in the manner described here, where city taxes are reduced by that $300. It still gets a little bit of a local option for $100, but it's now gone. It only gets a share. It gets $475, and the county tax didn't have to be compressed at all. Okay, and you back down, the total comes back down to $1,500. Okay, here's just an example, and that finishes the slides, actually, other than to show you the extent to which compression has occurred in relative terms, anyway, between school districts and non-school districts. And you'll see over more recent years, the red marking the school districts, you'll see compression losses. Well, they lost a lot back in 95 and 96, as that earlier graph table showed you, where they were severely constrained and they were rolled back from $15 per real market value all the way down to 5. Okay, but then after that, the compression changes, it's pretty variable over here. The numbers below show you kind of what the values are in terms of compression losses for the last few years. Okay. If you have any questions, this is
Chair, sure, I have a question.
Representative Boklas.
Can you tell us how many counties are compressed now or maxed out?
I think that data, Dr. Warner, that might be in our LRO report.
I know that the data is in the big the big report.
Quite a bit of this data that I've aggregated came from either the departmental report or the LRO report.
Thank you.
Representative Boklas.
I might suggest, Mr. Chair, Representative Boklas, if you'd like to know individual counties or a specific question, we could even look that up for you and aggregate that for you if you'd like.
At this point, are you going to take over on slide 56?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have a section on urban renewal. It's a two-week session, but we have just under 10 minutes. So I'll just give you the highlights of urban renewal, and there's a lot of highlights to urban renewal, actually. It's a very popular program, and it's a program that was instituted in 1960, and it provides in the Constitution for taxes to be divided. There's an urban renewal agency created in every city and county in the state by law, and it's activated only at their discretion. So there's a lot of inactive urban renewal agencies in the state, but there are a number of active ones too. And they can activate and they can use that agency to get grants and funds and federal. But they can also use a tool that's called tax increment financing. Tax increment financing is a method by which an increment is identified and a tax is derived from that increment, and then it finances the projects. The urban renewal agency decides to activate. It identifies tax increment financing as a tool. It identifies an area, and that area is blighted, and it says that it's blighted, and it has to be blighted in order to have this program. So they say, we would like to improve the blight in this area, and we'll focus on this area. We'll set the standard. We'll let the assessor know. The assessor creates the boundaries, and the value for that year that it's activated is frozen. So if there's $300 billion in that area in downtown Portland or wherever it happens to be, that's frozen value. The theory is that any value increase in that designated area is above that frozen value is called excess value. The excess value is the portion that the urban renewal agency is going to benefit from. It's going to tax that excess value. So the excess value, the growth in value in that area, theoretically is attributable to the work that that agency is doing in that area to improve the blight, to remove the blight. It may provide infrastructure. It may provide incentives for industry to come in or manufacturing or finance. I mean, could do a lot of different things. But what it does is then it takes the tax rates of the taxing districts in that area, multiplied by that excess value, and that's urban renewal revenue.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Riley.
So a urban renewal district could activate and do nothing and then start charging tax on that above that frozen rate.
Well, I don't think so. I think that the way it's set up in urban renewal, we have quite an active one where I come from, that you can't activate that and then do nothing. You have to have a plan, and I believe the plan's a 20-year plan. And you have to have specific goals. You have to have everything lined up to where your money's come in at a certain time, and then you name your projects. And I think we have like 18 of them. And you can't just activate one and then do nothing. Okay.
Okay. I can finish up fairly quickly. I talk faster than John. urban renewal in Oregon has grown substantially. You can see here from this slide that in 1999-00, there were 40 UR agencies and about 58 plans. Today, there are about 51 agencies and 74 plans, and several other plans may start the addition of tax within the next 2 years. John helped me get the data for this. Apparently, the Dallas UR is likely to divide tax. That means it's going to impose a tax based on incremental value. Starting in 05-06, the Portland Willamette Industrial UR plan was approved in 2004 and may start the division of tax in the next 2 years. The Salem Regional Employment Center, Mill Creek, plan will probably divide tax in 2 years from now. And the Silverton plan area was approved in November, and division of tax date is unknown or uncertain at this time. The Springfield UR has been approved by voters, and it will probably divide tax 2 years from now. And the city of Phoenix is in the process of developing a UR plan. Here are some of the additions to that have, the new agencies and plans that have been created since 99, and how much money they've actually accumulated, how much money was frozen, how much excess value, which is the amount of the increment that they've used to develop or implement their plans that have been approved. Here are the number of additions to existing agencies. So, for example, Multnomah is a huge, you know, UR agency with many plans. It has about 10 plans right now, and these three were developed within the last since 99. Okay, here's a breakout basically of how much value has been excess value has been used from the plans that have been added in the last few years versus those that have been added since before 99, I should say. UR sources, John mentioned, division of tax. I don't think you spent a whole lot of time on the special levy, did you?
None.
Okay, well, you might want to mention that that is something that, should, it really comprises a limited amount at this point. I think in the last year it comprised about $100 million, roughly, of a maybe $100 million?
I don't know.
$20 million, I'm sorry, $20 million. Out of $139 million in taxes. The rest was division of tax. And I will skip through this part and just focus in on a little example here showing you how the differences between using the authority that one has as an agency. If you were created prior to 1995-96, you would have been given a special UR levy, which is a maximum authority, correct? And you would have given certain options whether and how you wanted to finance your plan through the use of total incremental financing or through the use of the special levy, okay? If you were created after 1996, you don't have that option any longer. You just are totally using 100% of your or you use incremental financing, okay? And so I think the graph that we show you or the data that we have on special levies showed historically they represented much more than they do now because more of the more recent developments of the plans by some of the agencies don't use a lot of their maximum authority. They're working pretty much off division of tax. But in this case, I wanted to show you the differences and how it would apply to a bill because if you are using incremental financing, your tax statement changes by the addition of, well, your tax statement changes. It doesn't quite appear in the statement. Your incremental financing would take a chunk of the bill that you see here. Suppose, for example, that you're assessed you had a particular property in an urban area, an urban renewal area, and the real market value of that property were, say, $50,000, but the frozen value, that's the value it was given when it was in poor, blighted condition, was $10,000. But today it's worth $50,000. Well, you've got, $30,000 is the incremental value in the assessments. Well, your share of that total assessed value is roughly 75%, is it not? 10 over 40, right? You've got, 30 over 40. You've got about 75% that is of the assessed value of this property has been created because of the plan that improved it. So on this particular tax bill, once we go down, we went down through the same example, the tax bill is computed. It meets the governmental M5 limit percentage there. And how do we know how much the UR agency gets? It gets 75% based on that share that's computed up at the top of the table. Okay. Outside the UR area, okay, you'll notice that there is no change. There is no application of frozen value. Okay. And so it's only when you're dealing with incremental taxing, you look at the property within the UR area, you figure out how much is incremental relative to the initial amount that it was worth, and that's how you figure out the share that goes to the UR plan area when you're taxing, and the rest goes back to obviously the taxing districts, right? The UR agency does not have to impose its full taxing authority. Am I not correct on that, John? I mean, it could take 60% if it wanted to.
Prior to Measure 50, it was allowed to do that, and then at Measure 50, there was three choices given to any existing urban renewal agency, and one of the choices was for that agency not to exert its full authority in any given year. So that would be an Option 3 plan. But
okay. Now, just notice as another example, though, the last example shows you what happens if you decide to use your special UR levy. Okay. In this case, it's rather slightly different because the UR, the urban renewal special levy that we talked about briefly when I said there's two types of urban renewal taxes, special levy and division of tax. If you impose a special levy, if the urban renewal agency imposes or uses part of its maximum authority to impose a special levy, that tax is distributed across the entire municipality, not simply restricted to the UR district. So the example here shows you how it was how it's restricted. So there's a big difference between whether a UR agency decides to use a portion of its maximum authority through the use of a special levy versus using incremental financing. Okay. Total revenues for UR in your urban renewal revenues was about $139 million. Versus $101 million back in 1978-79. The average growth rate for this period has been about 5.2%. Revenue growth rate over the prior year, that's just actual growth rate, was about 4.9% in the growth of UR revenues. We'll go forward a little bit. We'll move fast on that. And here's just my last slide that will just give you something I pulled together yesterday that would be... It's not presented in any of the individual reports because you'd have to pull data together from separate reports. But I really thought it was kind of interesting. I took all of the UR revenues by agency, aggregated them by county, and then sorted them according to, like, the amount of taxes collected for the counties in terms of size. So you've got the first block of counties whose county taxes printed there in orange on the right side, were less than, let's say, $50 million in taxes. And you can see how much UR revenue in the yellow was generated as a percent of those total taxes. Mm-hmm. The second block has counties that were taxing between $50 million and $300 million. You can see what share of UR revenues were used. And they range quite differently between, you know, 1%. It does not take a huge amount of total revenues that's being put into urban renewal, actually. And then you get down into the last three counties, which have the huge counties, Multnomah being one of the largest counties that have 10 districts, and you'll see you've got about 9% of total taxes going towards urban renewal. You can't really draw any distinctions at this point about the data as far as what the relationship is between, like, the change in revenue in urban renewal relative to the growth rate or change in revenue at the total, because you'd have to know more about the actual, I would call it the implementation period of the urban renewal project. In the smaller districts, in smaller counties and smaller districts, you may have projects that might be very 1 to 2 years in duration, and so you'll see at some point that the growth rate of 03-04 over the prior year might be negative in some cases because you might phase it out. So it was just an example to show you how small relative to county revenues urban renewal really takes. And that basically summarizes most of what we have for you. And I thank you. If you have any questions?
Madam
Chair?
Yes, I got handed the gavel by our...
Quick question from Legislative Revenue. Do we anticipate some UR discussions? Are there UR bills that have presently been filed in the House or the Senate?
Mr. Chair, we do anticipate some discussion. It's not
of the magnitude it was several years ago, as the committee spent a lot of time on this, and then in 99 and 01 when the three different options were clarified. I have seen some bills relating to it, but a fairly small amount. We could certainly have, there's an urban renewal statewide organization. We can have them come in and other sources of information.
We'll have to get these schedules printed up in a little bit larger print than what they are at that point.
Other questions? I know if I could make one comment here with regard to property taxes, the one thing that I've taken away from this presentation is that code area, there are the slides that make generalizations around statewide issues aren't very valid in this region because everything is highly specialized in this area down to the little property tax line, which makes it very hard to get a handle on this particular sort of system of taxation. So I think the most important thing is to sort of take how it's derived in Oregon, and then as we move forward on specific bills, we'll get more and more information. So thank you for presenting this. It's very difficult stuff, I think. Further questions? Anything else for the good of the order that I should know about, Mr.? Then we are adjourned for the day.
Good job.